All right, you're listening to the Bon Appetit Foodcast. I'm Adam Rappaport. On today's show, Brett Martin, chief food critic for GQ magazine, my former place of employment. I've known Brett for, God, like ever, like 20-some years now. He and I used to work together at Time Out in New York. He's one of the best food writers out there. And some years ago, he relocated from Brooklyn to New Orleans, which I think you can make the case is probably the most storied food city in America. So I talked to Brett about what's been happening down in NOLA, what's been opening up there lately, how the city has changed since Katrina food-wise. And we also get into the world's 50 best restaurants list, a topic that I definitely have a few thoughts on, and one in which Brett wrote a really great piece for GQ on a few months back. But before we get into that, we have an exclusive offer for podcast listeners. You can get a one-year subscription to BA for just 6 hours. 12 issues, $6. That's like 50 cents an issue. That's embarrassingly low. And that's half off what you'd be paying normally. Plus, you get a BA apron. You got like a cool blue apron thingamajiggy. That's pretty cool. Do it now, and you get the August issue on your doorstep shortly. Just go to bonappetit.com/foodcast. All right, so let's do the show. Here's me and Brett Martin. Like every other song. Brett Martin, you're back in New York City.
It's good to be back.
How many years has it been since you moved to New Orleans?
I moved to New Orleans on January 10th or so, 2011. So we're coming up on 6 years.
Now, what I find fascinating about you is that when you were here in New York, and guys like Adam Sachs and I knew you back in our days at Time Out, and you were pretty much the most Brooklyn person we knew. And I don't mean Brooklyn in like sort of mustache, bearded, tattooed, making your own bitters at home.
No, the other Brooklyn.
I mean like, yeah, egg creams and Brooklyn Dodgers.
Yeah, well, I mean, where do you find that anymore? You got to leave.
You
got to go to New Orleans.
You got to. So you moved to New Orleans. It was like, what, Brett Martin's moving to New Orleans? That's insane. And then within 6 months, it seemed like you were Mr. New Orleans.
Well, I would never claim to be Mr. New Orleans, but I will say that I took to it. I liked it pretty quickly. And Brooklyn and I had grown apart. Let's just put it that way. It was just a mutual thing. We both moved on. Brooklyn's doing fine without me, you know.
You're trying to say you're not really part of this new Brooklyn?
I had to go away in order to not be infuriated by New Brooklyn, basically. And that's good.
I almost did a spit take right there.
It was not healthy for me to, you know, and that's fine. The city changes. I'm old. My father was in Brooklyn. You know, the things that he knew as a young person in Brooklyn aren't there anymore. Why should that mine be there anymore? But when I lived there, I was angry a lot.
You'd also gone through a bad breakup, correct, before leaving?
I had.
Yeah, a couple of them maybe.
I mean, yeah, if you count my whole life, yeah. I'd been there. I mean, I lived in Brooklyn essentially for 40 years. I mean, a little
and
less than 40
years. Both
your
parents are from New York.
Both my parents are from Brooklyn, yes.
Yeah.
And my grandparents.
Yeah, so you're about as Brooklyn as they come.
Yes. Yeah, I'm full on stickball, egg cream.
Spalding.
Spalding, sliding ponds.
Pee Wee Reese. We can just keep going.
Yes.
When you moved to New Orleans and all of a sudden you're walking down the street with the Sazerac and stuff, did you feel like a traitor?
No, not in the least.
Really?
No.
There wasn't a pang of like, ooh, I feel bad for enjoying this?
No. None at all. I mean, I felt like a poser sometimes. Like I felt like I didn't really necessarily deserve to feel as at home in New Orleans quite yet. But
yeah.
But New Orleans, you know, is like New York, a place you can go and I think, kind of make yourself at home pretty quickly. It's also not that different. I mean, in the grand scheme of things, even though it's in Louisiana, you know, it's a urban, diverse place, you know.
It's interesting. It's like I've been living in New York 22 years now, and I finally feel like I can say that I'm a New Yorker. And I imagine New Orleans is such a unique place, and I guess where I might disagree with you in terms of the New York-New Orleans comparison is that I just feel like, I mean, when you're in New Orleans, it literally feels like you're in another country. It is such a unique city, area. I could not compare it to another major city in the United States.
No, I think that's what makes it so wonderful. I mean, it's probably less so now that a bunch of New Yorkers have moved down there. And, you know, like everything else, we have, you know, the most popular restaurant in town is a high-end Israeli restaurant. So it's not quite
Shaya.
In the last 6 years, that has changed dramatically. But it's still as far away as you can possibly feel in the United States. And that's part. And I lived, when I moved down there, I lived right in the center of the French Quarter. And like, I'd wake up and there'd be horses going by my 17th, you know, my 18th century house, and nuns, and people want, I mean, it was like living in, you know, some sort of wonderful tropical fantasy. And that's part of what makes it so, you know, alluring, is you can kind of live out that fantasy there.
Was it dangerous? And I don't mean in terms of like crime. I mean, in terms of like the fact that you could drink on the street and eat highly caloric, crispy food at all hours, and
I had a year.
I mean, like, kinda I like say, your freshman 15.
Yeah, I lived on as I say on Bourbon Street, right on the corner of St. Anne and Bourbon.
Why?
Because I had this amazing. I mean, that's the apartment I found, and it was St. Anne and Bourbon is the very, very center of gay French Quarter. There's like three drag clubs, you know, on the corners there. And like I would fall asleep at night. I've said this line many times. I would fall asleep at night, like with listening to like drag queens doing Whitney Houston covers, like in the, you know, through my wall every night.
I guess that's better than just
Yeah, well, it's not all that different. Like, it does lull you to bed. It's like listening to your parents, you know, having a party downstairs. And it was a tiring year. It set me back. I was writing a book. It took an extra year to write that book.
Yeah, because you had moved down there originally to finish your book, which you were writing on the sort of the golden era of cable television.
Right.
Sopranos.
It's called Difficult Men.
And you planned to move down there for 6 months and just to finish the book, right?
Yeah, originally 3 months. Yeah, correct. But then, as you so nicely pointed out, my life sort of fell apart here. a relationship ended, I lost, most important, as any New Yorker knows, I lost my apartment. And it's also, once you break away, like once I left New York, it just seemed utterly ludicrous to come back to New York.
Yeah, and pay.
I mean, just to begin a life, yeah,
apartment.
Yeah. And I didn't have the hang up. I mean, this is the nice thing about being from here, is it didn't feel like a defeat in any way.
Yeah,
you know,
you've done it.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'd never had the chance to move to New York the way other people do, and this in some ways was my moving to New York.
What food things about New Orleans when you first moved there did you really fall for?
I mean, you know, that's the amazing thing, is for a tiny little city, the number of food things, like, you know, special food things, and then the number of food things tied to festivals, so that they only come around once a year. It's just disproportionate. There's just so many. The thing I don't care that much about is snowballs, which is a do you know what snowballs are? They're like
shaved ice.
Slurpee. It's not a Slurpee. I'm going to get totally lambasted at home because they're shaved ice with syrup.
But they get spit out of the machine that grinds up the ice.
Precisely. People really, really dig them.
Really?
And I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's very hot, you have to understand. So like, but it's, yeah, I couldn't, not my thing. Not how I choose to spend my calories.
I also like, I can't get that excited about syrupy ice.
Yeah, I mean,
like, I get if I was like 9, sure.
There are a lot of people who could like have a coherent rebuttal to what you just said, like that. It's,
but adults,
it's more than that. Oh yeah. There's a very, very famous place called Hanson's Snowblizz, which has a patented snowmaking machine for this. And there's a line, and we're talking about 95 degrees, you know, and 100% humidity, and people line up around the block to get these things. I don't choose to do that.
What about po' boys? Because I'm always curious about a sandwich like that. I like the notion of them a lot, but I wonder if I lived there, would I eat them that often? I live in New York City, and I go to Katz's like once every 5 years to get a pastrami sandwich.
Yeah, I mean, it's sad. That's what happens when you live someplace. When I would visit, and then when I first moved down there, like fried shrimp po' boys were my favorite thing in the world. And I'll often go a month or something and forget that I, you know, haven't had one. That said, I eat a lot of them. I still eat a lot of po' boys. I mean, that, you know,
when do you take your po' boys? Is it a lunch thing?
That's a lunch thing. Yeah, most of the best po' boy
just
places are only
just
open
a nice light lunch.
Yeah, exactly. You have to basically decide you're going to torpedo your day. That's, you know, you just make a decision. It's like having a drink in the middle of the afternoon, which I also will do.
Well, you're also a self-employed, do I call it that? Or what do you call that, what you do? You're a writer.
I'm a writer.
You don't go to the office.
No.
And if you choose to partake in a nap on the sofa, you can do so.
Indeed.
And you do them often.
I believe in a nap on the sofa, yes.
So po' boy. So then, what about the drinking on the street thing? Was that like, oh my god, I'm just gonna go for a walk with a beer because I can?
You know, that feels very natural to me. I don't know what. I feel like that's the most civilized thing. I always thought that was an incredibly civilized thing.
It should be to
trust people. I mean, there's one thing about what people walking around with a neon green, you know, hand grenade on Bourbon Street,
yeah.
but like, but you know, just to be able to stroll, the trust that it shows in people.
New Orleans is a city that probably has deeper roots. In terms of food and food culture and restaurants than perhaps any city in America, perhaps for a while to its detriment, that it was kind of did not change.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say that in the last 5 or 10 years it has changed a lot, or at least since Katrina?
Oh, tremendously, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, even as I say, when I got there, you know, they had just opened John Besh and Alon Shaya, who then went on to open Shaya, had just opened a sort of serious modern Italian restaurant, and people were losing their minds because they thought
not in a good way.
No, in a great way.
Oh, yeah.
No, they loved it, but it was the kind of thing that it really had been elsewhere for a long time. You know, for the most part, you still, and it was wonderful because there were all these like living traditions of po' boys and gumbo, and you know, and but that's what you ate.
Yeah, and it just felt like Paul Prudhomme was cooking every meal all over the city for like 40 years.
Yeah, I mean, the old line was, you know, New Orleans, a city of 1,000 restaurants and one menu.
Yeah,
that was the, you know, and it wasn't all that untrue. I mean, it had started to change when I got there. But now, I mean, there's a New Orleans Tourist Board advertisement in Union Square right now where, like, for all of New Orleans history, you would have seen, like, Mardi Gras beads or, you know, a big thing of crawfish etouffee.
Yeah.
And now it's a picture of Alon Shaya holding pita bread.
Yeah.
That's completely mind-blowing. That, you know, the idea that that would be the thing that New Orleans is known for.
What year did Cochon open? That's Donald Link's restaurant.
2009 or 10?
And then he opened Pesh. And he really helped sort of I mean, is it fair to say that he helped spark the modernization of the?
I think so. I mean, I think that, you know, that I mean, those are very much Louisiana restaurants.
Interesting, because when I went to Cochon, it struck me as sort of Louisiana by way of Dave Chang or something. It felt very contemporary.
Well, I would say that it is contemporary, but it is rooted in ingredients and techniques from Cajun country, which is where Donald's from.
But the look of the restaurant felt very modern. Also, the preparation, the techniques, I also thought were very sort of what was happening right now in food.
Yeah. I mean, I can see that.
Cool.
I mean, that's part of the point, I guess, is that had not – those things were arriving finally at that point.
He did a good job at sort of taking something. I think that's what – you know, this goes with so many good, you know, restaurateurs who can take something that with tradition and integrity and bring it into the contemporary era.
I mean, it feels – I guess I'm hesitant to agree with you only because
– That's good. Arguing is good for
feels, a podcast. It feels legit, and it feels of Donald. It feels of the place. It feels,
I'm not saying it's gimmicky. I'm just saying
it
feels authentic, but it also feels modern. And I think that's not easy to do.
Yeah.
It's not
and
sticky.
I think Pesh, which is the sister, the sort of seafood-centric seafood, is probably the best restaurant to open since I've moved there. I would actually not say probably. I would say it is the best restaurant.
You're going on record.
Yeah. It's my favorite. And it takes that same DNA and applies it to seafood. And it's terrific.
One thing I do think that has not changed so much about New Orleans is how gutsy the food is, if that's the right word. It's very hard to find a meal that isn't full on in that city.
Yeah, I mean, again, that's another thing. Like when I first got there, it was like the only vegetables you'd get were in their Bloody Mary.
Yeah,
I mean, it is less true now than it's ever been, but it is not untrue.
Yeah. I was looking at our city guides on bonappetit.com, and there were some new restaurant write-ups for New Orleans. Restaurant Josephine
Estella.
Yeah. And there's a little note, like, go at happy hour and that for hush puppies with burnt ends and poutine with neck bone gravy. And I'm like, that's so New Orleans. It's like, you're not just going to get some like pretzels or pickles. Like, you're going to get neck bone gravy on your poutine.
Those are a couple of Memphis dudes, though. It's still a place that, you know, and that's the South in general, even despite the sort of new Southern cooking.
Yeah. So how do you survive week in, week out?
Well, as I say, you know, it's not as absolute anymore. I cook, I swim, and I, you know, I do my best.
In the river?
No, you don't swim in the river. You definitely don't swim in the river or the lake or any.
Well, that's an interesting question. So, you know, you cook, we cook. That's what we do here at Bon Appetit. How has the ingredient game changed down there in terms of sourcing good ingredients and getting what you want?
In some ways, it's just obviously we have a Whole Foods, and you get you sort of have access to kind of the universal world of fancy food.
Yeah.
You know, we don't have a good farmer's market, which is very depressing.
Are there good farms in the area? Or?
Well, yeah, Mississippi and northern. I mean, it's very – the summer is very hard. The summer is essentially what winter is like here in terms of – as far as I understand of growing. It is dispiriting that we don't have, like, a great farmer's market.
So, like, in August, are, like, tomatoes already done? It's just
tomatoes are done now. Yeah. I mean, tomato season has passed. Like, everything comes out really early.
Yeah. Like,
corn and tomatoes, all the stuff that we get in Massachusetts or here, you know, in late August.
What happens in fall then, in September and October, where it's still nice out, but...
It's a good question. I need
like
to.
You need to. If there was a farmer's market, you would.
Yeah, I know. I mean, it is. I mean, you know, there's. I mean, obviously, great peaches. There's great, you know, beans and stuff.
You know what you could do in your spare time instead of drinking during the day and taking naps? You could
start a farmer's market. Yeah, that sounds like a
you
lot
could
of fun.
Champion one. You'd be a local.
We have
hero.
One, and I don't mean to disparage it. It's just somehow it hasn't grown. And I think that they do. I don't know what the problem is, to be perfectly honest with you. Why it doesn't have the kind of bounty.
It's almost like if you were a reporter or something, you could actually look into
it. Yeah, it's almost as if you paid me.
You did a piece earlier this year, I thought a very well crafted piece, on the San Pellegrino 50's Best New Restaurants list.
Yes. I just want to remember, since we're talking about our history, it occurred to me last night, I remember our very first conversation.
Oh, good.
Which was, I lived in Brooklyn, and you called me, you were working at
City Search, which was the online sort of city guide.
Yeah. And this is just a sign of how, I don't think we're that old, mm-hmm. but how much has changed, is that what you needed to know is all about Brooklyn. Like, tell me about restaurants in Brooklyn. And the fact is that, like, I could do that in about 15 minutes.
In terms of, like, there was class places, but, like, that whole Smith Street thing.
Oh, I mean, that hadn't started at all. There was a place called Cucina, obviously, on Fifth Avenue. There was, like, and Peter Luger. I mean, basically, though.
And then what's his name opened Patois, which was kind of the first sort of new hipster bistro.
Yeah, I think before that was a place called Petit Crevette on Atlantic.
And
it was sort of like an outpost out there. But anyway, it was just, I mean, it was a completely reasonable question for, hey, Martin.
Tell me about Brooklyn.
And then, you know, and I was the one guy who had sort of, you know, could tell you about the five restaurants in Brooklyn. So anyway, I thought that was interesting. It makes me feel very, very old. But yes, I did this story about the world's 50 best is what I think it's technically called.
I have thoughts on the world's 50 best.
Do you? Do go on.
Well, I'm just curious about reporting this piece. So this is a compilation of the world's 50 best restaurants as written by sort of food world insiders, chefs, food writers, etc. It comes out each year in restaurants like, you know, the tops like Noma and, you know, El Bulli back in the day, Fran Adria, now Osteria Francescana in Modena. There is some controversy surrounding it. I'm curious, when you were reporting the list, were people willing to go on record? Were people like, I don't know if I want to talk about this? What was it like?
It's obviously very, very powerful. It's become more – I mean, the part of the story is how this list has gone from kind of relatively obscure and curiosity to super important. I mean, basically almost eclipsing Michelin, I'd say. Certainly eclipsing Michelin in the conversation for sure. I don't know economically whether it's still – I think stars still probably drive the most diners over, you know, in terms of – getting people into your restaurant. But for a certain kind of restaurant, for your Nomas, your 11 Madison Parks, your, you know, a kind of modern theatrical tasting menu type menu, it's the most important list.
It feels a lot more relevant.
People
in America don't talk a lot about Michelin.
No, and rightly so, because Michelin's kind of screwed up here, I feel like. You know, it hasn't really managed to, like, you know, get the feel for the place. Those people are pretty careful, definitely, and as they should be. You know, it's important to them, and it's hard to get people to speak kind of candidly about what they have to do to get the list, you know, to get on there, and how much they worry about it and what their concerns are about it. Because I think it does make a difference. And because it's voted on by chefs, diners, and press, I guess, three equal groups.
They projected in a way that this is almost like a scientifically tabulated, compiled list, and this one is better than that one. And I'm like, well, what does that actually mean? Like, so the 49th restaurant is – the difference between the 49th and the 22nd is what exactly?
Right.
What I like about – you do a Best New Restaurants list for GQ. We do one here at Bon App with Andrew Knowlton.
Is that something new that you're going to be doing this year?
You know, you have like guys like Jonathan Gold in LA who do their 100 best restaurants. What I do like about those lists is that it's very clear that they're subjective from one critic.
Yeah.
That this is Brett Martin's point of view. This is Jonathan Gold's point of view. And there's a very sort of detailed, hopefully eloquent, fun to read explanation of why you like a list. Pellegrino does not offer that.
Right.
You know?
No, I mean, I like the word favorite. I mean, to me, that's rather than best. You know, and in fact, we even say at GQ, we don't even say best new restaurants. We say perfect night out.
Yeah, which is,
you know,
yeah,
which is, and it just, it keeps it, I mean, it recognizes what we all know, which is that a meal it changes from night to night. It changes how you, by who you're with and how you feel.
You know. Well, that's my issue. I mean, I think also, I do think you mentioned in the piece, like, well, maybe it might make more sense if this were called the 50 most important or the 50 most influential restaurants in the world. And I think influential, I think that is a lot more fitting. That typically does not resonate as well with diners.
Well, you know why. Yeah. I mean, everybody involved is pretty straightforward about the fact that there is this flaw, that it's a silly project, you know, ultimately. I mean, they would not necessarily use that word, but I think that, you know.
Well, they didn't take it so seriously when they started it, the guys in London back. They had no idea that it would grow into this thing.
No, but I mean, they did it for the same reason we all in this business do it. It's a magazine that started, a restaurant magazine, and lists are, you know, they you get traffic and all that, you know.
I think what's cool about the 50 – you know, listen, like, chefs and restaurateurs work their asses off, like really, really hard. And it's really hard to make it in this business as a business. They deserve to be celebrated, and they deserve to have a chance to get together and celebrate with each other and have fun on that big night when the awards are announced. And, you know, I mean, that's great. That's like, every industry should have that. Yeah, I just have like I think also my one issue sometimes with you mentioned also that there's a great line in the piece about, you know, this is not a list of where to go to dinner tonight.
No.
That those types of restaurants, and I was talking to Mario Batali one time about this, and, you know, a restaurant like Osteria Mozza is never going to make it on the list. Even though it's a great restaurant that's fun, it's packed every night, Nancy Silverton's a wonderful chef, and just it does everything right that you want from a restaurant. But it's not important in that sort of pushing the boundaries sort of way. And without a critic's explaining of what the restaurant is like, I don't know what the takeaway from the diner is. Or is it even for diners? I don't know.
I guess, you know, they talk about it as a snapshot of what this particular class of people finds interesting at any given time. So it's, you know,
it's a pretty particular class of people.
Oh, absolutely. It's very, very rich people and very, you know, people who, and it favors this sort of by nature because it requires people traveling to go to these places and, you know, and then Instagramming and sort of, you know, keeping a kind of buzz about the place going, that it rewards novelty. It rewards, you know, this kind of newness.
That's cool. And I get that. I mean, this is not really for, you know, this is not about restaurants like La Grenouille here in New York City, a classic French restaurant that you wrote a beautiful piece on for Bon Appetit. It's not about some Galatoire's in New Orleans. I don't know. Like, every list is flawed, and I think it's up to the consumer of those lists to at least appreciate the flaws and be sort of cognizant of what's worthwhile about the list and what's a little just kind of ridiculous or arbitrary.
Right. I refer to it in the piece. I call it it's the restaurant equivalence of Rush.
You know, the band?
The band, Rush.
Wait, I read the piece just now. I didn't miss that line.
I don't know, man. You should read more carefully. And, you know, and that, you know, that you're supposed to appreciate the muse bouche more because you're told it's written in 12/5 time.
Yeah,
or whatever
okay, that
is.
One, yeah, but, yeah.
You
know, Neil Peart.
Yeah, and whereas, you know, I mean, as it happens, I have never been to Osteria Francescana, I'm sure it's quite good, but in Modena is a place called Osteria Giusti, which is in the back of a 150-year-old Salumeria, and you know, with a couple of wooden chairs, and
that's the meal I want when I go to.
It's the greatest lunch. I mean, if I had to compile my list of best lunches I've ever had,
see, that's what I'm talking about.
Is it would have been in that place. So there's a perfect lesson in what kind of place that is.
Yeah.
Exactly. It doesn't reward four time, like solid Ringo drumming.
Yes.
It's only
Ringo. Never gets the respect he deserves.
Absolutely not. To their credit, they will admit that it's not. It isn't. Once you start thinking about it that way, that it is not really a it's not a restaurant recommendation list. It's not a consumer guide. It's a the best way to look at it is this kind of measure of what a particular group of trendy people are interested in. The problem is,
but you get that. You understand that.
I get it, but I do. But that said, it does affect the kind of restaurants that are made. It does totally disproportionately reward white male chefs and Western chefs, and the process is weird and not totally transparent about. I mean, there's all kinds of lobbying that can go on, and it's the cool kids voting on cool restaurants, and it's an insider list for insider people, and that's it's got all the problems that has.
All right, before we let you go, lightning round.
Hit me.
All right, ready? Mm. Sazerac or Manhattan?
These are false choices, man.
Nope.
I don't want to give up either. I guess we're talking about what? Forever? Or just all right,
which
right.
one?
Sazerac.
Really? Wow.
Yeah.
Traitor. But who makes the best Sazerac in New Orleans?
Chris Hanna, I think, Arnaud's French 75 Bar.
Grilled oysters or oysters on the half shell?
Raw. Half shell.
If you're going to get them grilled, where do you go in New Orleans?
Drago's.
And that's the one near the airport?
It's in Metairie. There's one in Metairie. There's one at one of the hotels, too. But go to the one in Metairie. When I used to go down there, I'd time my flights to be able to go there from the airport before heading into the city.
Tony Soprano, Don Draper, or Walter White?
Tony?
Yeah. Tony? Any reason why? Just because he was the first?
He's the man. Yeah, he's the first.
Open container law in New Orleans or late night takeout delivery in New York City?
I am the one New Yorker who never ordered delivery. I don't believe in delivery. I never had it happen.
That's the dumbest thing you've ever said. What do you mean? You never order Chinese food?
No, I don't do it. I don't do delivery. I go and get it. I've never liked delivery. So that's easy. Open container law. We could have a long discussion about delivery some other time.
You do a lot of traveling, window or aisle?
Oh, window.
You don't feel boxed in?
I sleep.
But then what if you have to get up and go to the bathroom? Then you're like, excuse me, and you're stepping over people?
I can sit for 3 hours, but really? If I have to go, I don't mind bothering people.
See, I'm one of those guys. I don't sleep. I stay hydrated, and I always have to go pee.
Yeah.
So that's why I take the aisle.
So, maybe when I'm old.
Saints or LSU Tigers?
Ugh. Good God. New York Giants.
That is such a punt. You're not even a Giants fan.
Yeah, I'm not really. No. I guess the Saints. Yeah, sure, the Saints.
Okay.
Sorry.
They've been a fun team. Dixie or Brooklyn Brewery?
Dixie.
Thank you. Shrimp or oyster po' boy?
Ooh. I do like a combo, but I'd go shrimp if I had to.
Final question. Butter or olive oil?
Butter.
Good answer. Brett Martin, thank you for coming by.
Thank you very much.
This podcast has been brought to you by Bell Cushing and Carrie Polis, with editing by Mooj Zaidi and additional help from Christina Che and Lily Sherman. Our theme music is by Valerie and the Greedies. We have new episodes every Wednesday, and if you want to tell us anything about this or any episode, please email us at bonappetitfoodcast@gmail.com.